From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The proliferation of misinformation, fake news, propaganda, clickbait, and other contaminants of our information sphere is a central issue in our political and cultural landscape. There is so much false information on the internet that it's often hard to tell fact from fiction, so much so that many Americans have simply lost trust in news sources, believing everything is simply a matter of opinion. But facts do matter, and truth matters. Writing a book about how to tell if something is true or false is my guest, Cindy Otis, a cybersecurity expert who regularly speaks and writes about political and national security issues for various media outlets. She's also a former CIA analyst. She joins me to discuss her new book titled True or False, a CIA Analyst's Guide to Spotting Fake News. Welcome to the program, Cindy.
Thank you, Sonali.
So what led you to write this book? This is a topic, as I mentioned, that is so central to our cultural and political landscape. It's an issue that is talked about a lot. So I imagine that for you, this must have been a no-brainer to put this out. And I should mention, this is written in a format for young adults, so very much valuable for teenagers and older, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My hope, of course, is that it's accessible to, you know, every reader at every level. But essentially, I decided to write this book starting in about the mid-2017 timeframe. I had just left the CIA, and it was just a couple of months after, you know, Americans and the world started to wake up to the fact or learn about the extent to which Russia interfered in our presidential election in 2016. And so naturally, you know, people had questions. What does this mean? What did they do? You know, how much did it influence the election? But also, you know, can I trust what's showing up on my social media feeds? Am I being manipulated? How do I sort out sort of fact and fiction, that sort of thing? And, you know, I started writing publicly on national security issues just as a way to provide context about some of these very serious current events in the national security space. And I started getting a lot of questions from people who just wanted to know, you know, how do I make sense of what I'm seeing? I'm feeling so overloaded by information. What sources do I trust? How do I find, you know, find out if there are Russians in my feed? That sort of thing. And I quickly realized that, you know, the advice that I was giving was based on, you know, of course, my experience in the intel community as an analyst sorting through just massive amounts of information and trying to analyze, you know, very rapidly current events, that this was very, very applicable to everyone, just sort of trying to make sense, at least, of their news feeds and their social media feeds. And then I especially wrote it for young adults because, you know, young adults are more online than any generation. We've sort of built this gigantic social media architecture for them and then sort of passed over this problem of, you know, you are under a fire hose of information from the day you're born. Good luck with that, you know? So my hope was that by targeting young adults in particular, by giving them the tools and tactics that they would need to sort out the true from the false, that then we would have a generation of, you know, very informed individuals who think critically and ask the questions that they should be asking.
So your first section of your book actually looks at the history of fake news. You say that fake news has been around a lot longer than we think. I suppose for as long as humans have had news sources, there have been attempts to manipulate those in order to, you know, spread certain narratives that may take advantage of people's existing fears. Give me some of the examples that you relate in your book as those historic fake news moments.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right in saying, you know, this goes back to essentially communication. So I start the very first historical example that I talk about is Jack the Ripper, technically, but it's just to sort of make a larger point. And then I go into all the way back to Ramses II, who sort of, it was reported for centuries that he had won this war because he proclaimed that he did, had it sort of engraved on temples and things like that, that he won this this war sort of single-handedly. And then it wasn't until, you know, historians many centuries later were combing through letters and things like that from this era, in which they found that, in fact, he did not win this war. He was essentially trying to save face. So I go sort of all the way back to examples like that. I also talk about the founders of the United States, who many of them either funded, you know, press or media outlets, newspapers, as a way of getting their stories placed, being able to target their political rivals and things like that, or they ran sort of the press themselves. And certainly, you know, it was very important for me to show throughout the book that so many of these narratives that we are seeing today, these false narratives that go viral on Twitter, are things that have actually, you know, happened over time. And especially when we talk about how marginalized communities have been targeted with false information, that's something we've seen throughout history. False information weaponized by leaders to, you know, justify violence against, you know, Jewish people in Europe throughout history, to, you know, target other marginalized individuals. That has been a common thread throughout, and we certainly see it happening today as well.
You have a chapter entitled Fake News and America's Founders. I imagine this is quite relevant these days because we seem to be having these discussions and, you know, some aspects of which are, I suppose, quite necessary about America's, you know, so-called founding fathers. During that era, during the early years of the formation of this nation, what role did fake news play?
It played an enormous role, frankly. The founders used false information to galvanize opposition to the British and then also the indigenous people as well. They used it to gain support for their wars, to boost recruitment, and then, as I mentioned, to target their political rivals as well, to get themselves into office. So, you know, we have sort of, I think in the United States, we have this idea of politics as well. Mudslinging happens, right? It's part of politics. But the interesting thing is that, first of all, that has gone all the way back to the founders of this country. But now that we have technology, social media in particular, that allows us to reach people rapidly in all corners of the earth, it's a lot more dangerous than just mudslinging to spread false narratives about your political rival or about particular communities in your country. Because, you know, essentially technology allows those false narratives to trend and reach in ways we've never seen before.
I want to skip ahead to what is so critically important these days, which is giving young people the tools to be able to determine what is real and what is not real. We are at a time that's unprecedented in human history in terms of being able to share information rapidly, but also to generate fake information. It is quite shockingly easy these days to create a narrative spun out of thin air. And of course, we have also entered the era of so-called deep fakes, which are these incredibly realistic looking videos that, you know, if you think that, well, I would only believe something if I saw it with my own eyes, even that doesn't hold these days. So when you say talk to, and through your book, talk to a young person who didn't necessarily grow up seeing, you know, physical newspapers in the home, who's didn't have a New York Times or a Los Angeles Times in their home that they associated with traditional media and maybe, you know, more trustworthy media, when they look at the internet, what advice do you give them to be able to tell whether a news source is trustworthy or not?
That's such a critically important question. So a couple of things. One, young people and even adults as well tend to think of what they see online, regardless of what type of content it is, as the same. So they'll look at a Facebook post by a random Facebook user as equal to, you know, a meme, as equal to a news article from a legitimate outlet, that sort of thing. And it's critically important to think about the fact that those different ways of producing messages are vastly different. The work that goes into, you know, creating a meme is nothing. You go to a meme generator, right? Anyone can create a meme. There's no verification. There's no, you know, sources that go into deciding what you put on that meme. There are no controls. There's no regulation. There's no policy, right? versus a media outlet, a legitimate media outlet that has things like fact checkers and editors and that sort of thing.
And that's not to say that those are infallible, because even with fact checkers, things can slip through the cracks. But when there are zero controls, there's basically a flood of information that there is no control over in terms of whether it's true or false.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a point that I make in my book that when, you know, legitimate media outlets get things wrong, that is not a sign that you can't trust anything they say. And that's something that's very important as well, particularly in breaking news situations. And this is another point that I raise for young people often. Breaking news situations or crisis situations, which it sort of feels like is reality 24/7 these days. But it's a scenario in particular where we're just flooded with more information than on an average day. And that's where a lot of rumors end up, you know, going viral more so than any other time. It's when false information can creep in. It's when we go to those legitimate news sources for information, they do have to update their stories as they get new information. They might have to correct their stories as they learn more and that sort of thing. And again, it's not evidence that this is not a legitimate media outlet because they're changing their story. It, you know, is typically because they've gotten new information, right? So a lot of these tips that I give young people, and I can talk about some more as well, but a lot of them are geared at what we don't want to have happen is that, you know, they end up not trusting anything because we're asking them to ask questions and look at information critically.
And that's such a critically important issue. I mean, in interactions that I've had with folks, they seem to have gotten so cynical that they have dismissed all media outlets. The media is just trying to gaslight you. This is now sort of a favorite theme among people, which means that the only information they trust is that which may say come out of the mouth of their favorite leader like Donald Trump. So it's that's a critically important aspect of it. And it's one that I think is quite deeply distressing, because journalism and media and press freedoms, that's an integral part of democracy. Doesn't democracy erode when people's trust in all journalism erodes?
Absolutely. And that is my primary motivation for having written this book, is to give people the tools and tactics so that they can continue to, you know, consult good and accurate information, ask tough questions, spot false content for themselves, and also not be led to these more fringe ideas. Because what we're seeing is that when people feel like they can't trust the institutions they have traditionally relied on for accurate information, they're not moving to better sources, they're moving to worse sources, right? They're moving to conspiracy theories. They're moving to, like you said, that favorite politician that they just decide is 100% right 100% of the time. And that is not the way to go either. And then there's also sort of the other piece of it where people withdraw from their communities in general. They withdraw from things like their right to vote and participate in the democratic process because they feel like, well, you know, can I trust anything? Does it matter? Does my vote count? And that sort of thing. So rebuilding that trust in institutions, it goes hand in hand with teaching people how to think critically about the information that they're seeing so they don't withdraw.
As a journalist, one of the things that I instinctively do when I see a meme that someone on social media posts is to check it against fact-checking websites. And you have a section in your book, which this I feel like is a very critical tool. And it's a simple thing that people can do to bookmark on their web browsers the websites of these trustworthy fact-checking sources. Can you give me some of those that you think are important as part of the arsenal of how to tell whether something is true or false?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that fact-checking organizations are doing incredible work. They are usually, you know, nonprofit organizations that are based on grants and donations and things like that. So they're typically very underfunded, and as a result, they have to prioritize what they are able to fact-check. So they tend to focus on primarily viral content that is gaining a lot of notoriety. So Snopes is a fantastic example, doing fantastic work. The Poynter Institute is also doing fantastic work. Several media outlets have sections dedicated to fact checking. The folks at BuzzFeed News They do a lot of fact checking for content that's going viral around particular topics, and they'll debunk things like memes and imagery, you know, photos taken out of context, that sort of thing. So there are a number of organizations.
PolitiFact is a really good one as well.
PolitiFact, yes, yes. Absolutely.
And it's really sad because there are also claims about these fact-checking websites themselves that are false. Mm-hmm. Here we get into the sort of meta-level fake news and propaganda that these fact-checking websites are funded by liberal billionaires and intended to fool people, which again tends to fuel this deep skepticism among many people in the public.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think the conspiracy of censorship is a real problem when we talk about disinformation and how to engage with people, how to do fact checking in a way that helps people think about the information that they're seeing. And there's this, as you said, there's a sort of like meta sort of counter argument that has certainly arisen in the last couple of years of any sort of fact checking is censorship of a particular political idea.
How about the issue of creating fake content itself? I mentioned deep fakes, and this is something that you also tackle in your book. First of all, what are deep fakes? What role have they played? I mean, I know that in other nations right now, deep fakes are playing an even bigger role, and it is a warning, I think, to the U.S. about the role that deep fakes can play and will likely play in our near future.
Yeah, so deepfakes are something that are certainly being developed worldwide. It's essentially sophisticated technology that allows for the merging of imagery with fake audio, essentially. So, for example, you can have a politician look like, you know, actually look like he or she is saying something that they are not. It sounds like them, it looks like them, the mouth is moving, that sort of thing. We haven't seen that be rolled out sort of broadly across elections yet, which is of course our fear. What we end up seeing certainly more so today at this point is more manipulated and edited kinds of content. Photos, actual photos of real things taken out of context, or video that you can edit in just a couple of ways, whether it's taking out pieces of a clip to make a person look like they're saying something, those are hugely believable. They go viral all the time. And it's using technology that you can download on your smartphone, and you don't need to be sort of a video editing wizard to make those kind of edits that are really, really convincing.
The issue of bias is an important one as well. And unfortunately, as I mentioned in my introduction, because people have become so deeply skeptical of information sources, they have reduced discourse to opinion. Well, it's all a matter of opinion. You are making these claims because this is your bias, etc. And of course, the truth is we all are biased. And I'm wondering how you tackle this information, this aspect of the conversation around fake news. Obviously, we are biased. How do you account for bias and still make the claim that facts matter?
Yeah, so, you know, the bias piece is so enormous. And I don't think that most people understand the extent to which our own opinions, our own perceptions, and our own experiences as human beings really give us this unique lens through which we look at information. We decide if something is true. Even the information that we seek out is all affected by this. And so step number one is recognizing that you have biases, and even creating a catalog of them. Writing them down, I think, is actually a hugely important process to recognize these are the lenses that I wear, right, that affect how I'm seeing, interpreting, analyzing, and spotting information. So, you know, if you look at me, I am a privileged white woman, I'm disabled, I was really raised in a religious household. Those sorts of things absolutely have affected throughout my life the kinds of content that I click on at the end of the day. And then on top of that, algorithms through search engines on our social media feeds are geared towards stoking that bias, right? They show us content that they think we are most likely to click on. That's how they generate revenue. And so we are actively shown things that confirm our bias, confirm our opinions, And on the inside, what we're doing is we're hunkering down further in our perceptions and our opinions. We're growing more confident because the algorithms continue to show us what we already believe. So it's a hugely problematic issue. But step one really is recognizing you have them, cataloging them, and then actively, you know, making sure that you have that in the back of your mind when you're looking at content.
There is the issue of polling that I'd like to tackle, which I'm also so glad that your book took on as we are in election season. Every day there's a new poll. Politicians know that you can manipulate a poll to reflect an outcome that's favorable to you by asking the right kinds of question or narrowing the field, the pool of respondents. How do you take on the issue of polling? Because of course, the average American is not a statistician. Maybe they took a statistics class in high school or college, but probably not. And when scouring the news, you just look at the headline, get your takeaway, and I know I've been guilty of this too, and think that you've understood what the poll said.
Right. So polling is such a complicated issue. It can be helpful in understanding where certain groups of people are on a particular issue at a certain period of time. That's essentially what polling looks at, if it's done well, right? And then from there, if you continue to do that polling, you can look at things like trends over a period of time. But I think, you know, it's probably unrealistic to expect everybody to, you know, go as an adult, go take a stats class if you didn't before, learn about how polling works. And so I try to give sort of a basic framework for people to think about when they're looking at polling. So it's asking yourself and looking into who actually conducted the poll, because political campaigns pay companies to conduct polls for them, right? And then they release the results, presumably favorable results, right? What kinds of questions did they ask? Over what period of time did they ask these questions? How many people did they poll? And then it's important, again, I sort of mentioned this earlier, but it's important to recognize that most polling is, you know, views by a certain group of people at a certain period of time. So when I look at election related polling, I sort of nod my head at a headline. I might look at the polling itself, but it's, you know, it's kind of a, okay, this is what one group may be saying, on we go, keep getting the vote out, you know?
So does it make sense to think about whether repeated polls have similar results? I mean, you know, it's like if you're taking a coronavirus test and you take 10 tests and 8 out of 10 give one result and 2 give another result, that you're more likely to believe the one that has given, you know, the result that is seen more often?
I mean, certainly polling that's focused on identifying trends over time can be more reliable. It depends on the topic, really. I mean, I was thinking the other day about how polling is going to be affected so much this year because of all of the coronavirus is just, it's something my generation has never faced. So how do you work coronavirus into polling about things like, what stores do you shop at? That's radically changed for me, that answer, right? Or, you know, polling about gun violence in schools. Well, schools haven't been open. How do you account for that? So polling over time can certainly identify trends, but there are always these sort of these one-off things that can sort of throw a wrench in it. So polling is a tough issue.
And then finally, Cindy, your book has a lot of exercises in it, a lot of tips. Is this the sort of book that you hope can be a handbook for not just young people who it's written for, but also the general public in terms of going through the exercises, you know, looking at all of the ways in which we can reveal our and understand our own biases and maybe come to an understanding of which sources we can trust and can't trust? Just last thoughts on how you would like for people to use your book?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm hearing a lot from adults who are using it themselves around my age or older. And I think it's because, you know, they're finding it useful and doing those exercises as useful. And I'm hearing, you know, good things about things that people have learned. And I think that's because my generation and older, you know, we were the generation that got internet in our homes for the very first time. It's sort of, you know, we went from hard copy encyclopedias to the internet. And so my generation had to learn how the internet worked. And then we sort of built all of this technology in some cases, not thinking about the consequences and how that feeds into disinformation and misinformation. So my generation, frankly, and older generations need as much help as young folks who are technically savvy, but have this giant mess that we've sort of left them.
Well, Cindy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest is Cindy Otis, a cybersecurity expert who regularly speaks and writes about political and national security issues for various media outlets. She's also a former CIA analyst, and we've been discussing her new book, True or False, A CIA Analyst's Guide to Spotting Fake News. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.